Hey now, and welcome to the City Off Campus podcast with your two favorite hosts, Sammy Sommerfeld and Jack McFarland. Today, we have a guest that we're very excited about to have on the podcast. We have a former Hawkeye, but also a Chicago Bears great and 1985 Bears Super Bowl champion, Jay Hilgenberg. How's everything going with you?
Going great, guys. Thanks for having me. It's nice talking to people connected with Iowa.
Of course. So my first question for you is actually an Iowa-related question. What was your journey to being a Hawkeye as a kid from Iowa City? Like, with your dad being a former Hawkeye, did you ever really feel like you had a choice to be anything but a Hawkeye?
No, I remember I remember like the first letter I got from a college. It was like Brown University. I think that was before they looked at my transcripts, but then I got a letter from Iowa State University my junior year. And I remember I put it on the dinner table and my dad looked at it and stuff. And like the next day or something like that, it so happened my best friend, in high school, that one of my best friends, I had a lot of buddies in high school, of course, but he was the quarterback, and Bob Cummings Jr., and his dad was the head coach, so we were best buddies. I was the center, and my dad's connection with football, that I kind of knew after I threw that little letter up there at Iowa State, that it was kind of, I was known to me my junior year in high school that I knew if I wanted to play football at Iowa, it was available for me.
So that actually leads to my next question, which was, what was the transition like from Bob Cummings to Hayden Fry, Bill Snyder like? And how did you see in those early years the culture start to shift in those early Fry years?
Well, I tell you, I feel like I've always taken something from every coach that I've ever been coached by. You know, it really goes to my high school. I'm so fortunate that my Clyde Bean was my high school football coach and wrestling coach. I mean, I didn't have a day off from the end of football practice to the start of wrestling practice. It was the best thing for me. And when Bob Cummings was the head coach at Iowa, the 2 years I played under him, he, an ex-Iowa player, great player on the Rose Bowl team. He's a guy that you knew what pride was about, toughness and pride. I think that's what he really taught. The Iowa football program at that time wasn't really 100% committed. I remember Bobby Jr. talking about his dad. There are times he's out there recruiting on the recruiting road, and he had to come home because, the budget wasn't there. He couldn't keep recruiting. And then he ended up spending his own money to try to recruit guys to come in also. So, but then as soon as Hayden Fry came to Iowa, you could see the turnaround right there. I mean, it was an amazing, I remember just one of the first practices kind of looking at Hayden. I go, hey, we're going to win with this guy here. Unfortunately, it didn't happen my 2 years. The last 2 years I was there. We got close, but didn't happen.
So you talked about wrestling and playing football. How did, Iowa, just as much of a football school, it's a wrestling school. And, that's very ingrained in Iowa culture and sports culture. How did being a wrestler help you play the center position as you were kind of coming up?
It was everything. Especially in the NFL. I played on the day, they had the big nose guards at the 3-4 defense. He'd get right up. I played Jerry Ball. Our helmets would be touching. Beautiful. Hey, I'm going to get my hands inside, fight. I'm a wrestler. You're not going to beat me. So I encourage everybody. I'm wearing a wrestling sweatshirt right here from Illinois. I encourage anybody that wants to play football to go out for wrestling. Any position. I mean, the Bears have a great defensive back this last year, Buster Skrine. He's a 2-time Georgia State wrestling champ. So, I mean, all positions, you benefit from wrestling. But, wrestling's an awesome sport. And, I was at their college, the heyday right there, with Randy Lewis. We're the same age. We were freshmen together at Iowa with Randy Lewis and the Bannocks. And, I go back even further than that with the whole Iowa wrestling program. being from Iowa City, is Gary Kirtlemeyer was the head wrestling coach, and he's the one that brought Dan Gable to Iowa. And Gary Kirtlemeyer's son, Steve, we were high school. We were the same age high school, and we were on the wrestling team together. I mean, how crazy is that? I'm on the football team, the quarterback. I'm the center quarterback. His dad's the head football coach at Iowa. And then I go to wrestling, and then his son's on the wrestling team at Iowa. So I was always kind of around the Iowa wrestling program. If I didn't come from a football family, I probably would have gone and wrestled in college instead of played football. But I always knew there was kind of a little more money in football.
Being so ingrained with Iowa sports, how have you seen Iowa City change from the time you played there, grew up there to now? And like, what was Kinnick like back in the day when you played, where, you know, they didn't have the history of, you know, going to Rose Bowls and stuff, you know, being as competitive as they are today?
Right. No, I remember the old knot hole section, you know, they had like the end zone. You could just pay like 50 cents or whatever. It was inexpensive. I mean, I used to go over and sell Coca-Colas. I remember for a couple of years, I'd sell soda at the Iowa games until halftime, and then go over and sit in the northeast corner of the grass hill that used to be up there and watch the game. That was an awesome place to watch the game. It was great. It was a lot of just the great memories about Kinnick like that.
Circle back to your like experience with wrestling and how it helped with football. When I was at high school at Providence Catholic in New Lenox, one of the things that they made all O-linemen do was listen to their spiel about why you should do wrestling. And they said the same thing to D-linemen. And usually some of the best players that were on the team did wrestle as well, whether it was linebackers or running backs. Right. They have a certain toughness to them that you start thinking there is no odds that stacked against me. Like, I've had all of the odds stacked against me when I wrestle. So how did you, in an era where, how much did you weigh when you had played on the Bears? No more than 260 maybe?
No, I came in, my rookie year was 1981. And I remember Sports Illustrated did like the average size of every starter in the NFL at every position. So and the average size, the starting center in 1981, it was 6'2", 255. And that's exactly what I was coming into the NFL as a rookie. And I played most of my career, the earlier part of my career, like 263, 265, around there. But then when I would go against guys with Jerry Ball or something like that, I'd like to come in like 270, 272. So I tried to put some weight on during the week. And I don't know if it did anything for me. It just kind of made me feel a little more confident going against a 320 pounder.
So how have you seen that transition from maybe the 70s and 80s, where offensive linemen could get away with being 260, 270 pounds, where nowadays you see someone like James Daniels, who came in the Bears at like 290 pounds. People say he needs to bulk up to 300, yeah, whatever. And it's like, where was this necessity? Like, where did it come from for O linemen to just get even bigger than they were before?
Yeah. I mean, there's so many angles on reasons, for that. There's a couple stories that pop in my mind when you ask me that question. I remember my last year in the league, was 1993 season. And I remember I was playing at New Orleans, and it was bad weather, and we were shooting practice from an end zone camera way up in the Superdome. And it was a passing drill. And so I got in. It was even man defense. And that means the guards are covered and I'm uncovered. And I snapped the ball, and the pass protection was just don't let anybody come inside. So I hop over, you know, to this side, help this guard, hop over here to help this guard over here. And then the other center, there's another center that came in. This guy was this big, huge, young guy. Same play, same defense, or like that. He snaps the ball and just puts his hands out like that and does the same thing. And I go, ooh, that, you know, this may not be long for me here.
But your wrestling background, I was just going to say, your wrestling background had to have helped you, especially with your weight. I mean, all it is in wrestling, or not all of it, but a lot of it is using leverage and angles to your advantage and trying to just cut off one way so you can have them and move them where you want them to go.
Absolutely. You know, the Super Bowl. Super Bowl is the easiest game I ever played in. We kept running this play the first half, Matt Sui, our fullback. It's called the 31 influence. And it's here, you get the nose guard right on my head, and all he's doing is reading me. Where I go, he goes. And so this play was just the McMahon just gets the ball, turns right around, hands it to Sui, and he just reads me. And they wanted me to block it like a pass where I drop back. And I go, no, there's no way I'm going to block it that way, because people on TV may think this guy's bull rushing me, or like, you know, kicking my, you know, butt or something like that. And so I block it. I snap the ball, and I just make a quick movement there. I get, you know, wrestling hands inside. He takes that step, and whoo, you just launched him. I mean, we killed him on it. That was pure wrestling. And it got so much where I could control him. I was telling Bortz, Iowa, Mark Bortz, left guard, I go, hey, you better take a wide split for me, because this guy that I'm blocking is going to knock you off before you get to, he's going to go flying into you before you can get the linebacker. So yeah, wrestling is just huge for that. I love it when Matt Millen does Iowa games, and he always talks about the Iowa offensive line and the wrestlers. And Matt, he's a big wrestling fan, and he was always a fun guy to play. He talks as much as on the field when we played as he does in the booth too. He was pretty funny on the field.
Well, I mean, there's a lot to talk about when they have a guy like Tyler Linderbaum at center right now. I mean, the guy was a killer at wrestling, and he's a killer on the field as well. I wanted to just tail it back a little. How did you sign with the Bears after you had finished at Iowa? How did that come about?
My last game I played, and I played in a couple of college all-star games. And I was told I remember last game I played for Iowa was, I think it was at Michigan State. And I remember Clovis Hale was the offensive line coach, and he comes in, still had my uniform on. He sits down, and he goes, Jay, you know, you did a great job playing here at Iowa. He goes, you know, you're one of the best players I ever coached. He goes, but I don't think you're going to get drafted in the NFL. And I just go, whoa, you know, and I go, well, I'm going to prove that wrong. And then when I didn't get drafted, it hit me that I didn't get drafted, because I'd seen a lot of guys from Iowa go get free agent tryouts at clubs and not make it. And so I the Bears called me then, and I told them that I'm really maybe not interested. But then they go, hey, take a couple of days. And I took those couple of days and kind of looked around. There was a couple other offers. And actually, my uncle, Wally, who played at Iowa and played for the Vikings, the time that it was Jim Finks was the general manager and Bill McGrane was his assistant. Bill McGrane's dad used to be the sports editor of the Des Moines Register back in the 50s. And so they knew this whole Iowa connection, and knowing Wally and my dad, that, you know, they came in and gave me a tryout. And I remember Bill McGrane, they didn't know anything about me at all, though. I just couldn't believe it. I remember I was long snapping after the first practice I was there. And the head pro scout comes up to me, he goes, ask me if I long snapped in college. And I go, yeah, 3 years I did. He goes, really? Huh. So I knew then they never even looked. No one ever looked at me. And but Bill McGrane used to tell me the story. The first day of practice out there, Jim Finks came up to him during practice and said, he goes, hey, that hayseed from Iowa is going to be tough to run out of here. So. You know, I was around that Iowa wrestling room. I know how those guys competed. I fought, man. I went out and fought every day.
So I want to kind of ask you about the first couple years about the Bears. So obviously before the 85 season, there's a lot of games played and a few seasons to get to that point. So how was the culture, team chemistry, and team confidence being built from 81 to 85?
Yeah, so my rookie year was Neil Armstrong. He was the head coach, and he was like the defensive coordinator for the Vikings when in their heyday. And Buddy Ryan Neil Armstrong was the head coach. Buddy Ryan was the defensive coordinator. And then after that 81 season, they fired him, retained Buddy Ryan. Everybody knows the story, and brought Dick in. And then the first meeting we had as a team in 1982, Dick had the team together and goes, "All right, guys, there's good news and bad news here." He goes, "The good news is 3 years from now, we're going to be in the Super Bowl. Bad news is half you guys aren't going to be here." And I'm telling you, man, that's just intense football, intense all the time. But the great thing about it, if you were prepared, knew your assignments, and worked hard, Dick, we had the greatest coaching staff you could ever wish for.
What were the dynamics like between Buddy Ryan and Mike Ditka?
Yeah, I mean, Ditka just cared about winning. That's all he cared about. He didn't care about anything. He wanted to win a Super Bowl. Buddy had a little more of a chip on his shoulder about, kind of probably, being a little older, being in coaching a little more. Just kind of wanted to make sure that he wasn't lost in the shuffle, I guess. I'm not sure, but I first met Buddy Ryan when I was in high school. He was my uncle's position coach for the Vikings. So I remember meeting him when I was in high school. So going to training camp with, even a crazier story. I remember talking to Alan Page when I was a sophomore in high school at the Super Bowl IX, was that against the Steelers, Vikings Steelers? And I talked to him for like 20 minutes, and then that's who I practiced against my whole rookie year. It was Alan Page. But Buddy Ryan, I like Buddy. I like Buddy Ryan a lot. We owned a racehorse together. I think he was unbelievably great, great coach. He was kind of a tough guy. He was not many words, just wanted to see the production all the time, it's great. He's a great football coach, but he wanted to make sure that he wasn't overlooked at all. But I don't think we would have won the Super Bowl without Mike Ditka as the head coach.
What did you enjoy about playing for Dick Stanfill as your O-line coach? And he was a Hall of Famer himself, Pro Bowler, all pro player. So what did you learn from him where he was coming from 50s style football and obviously getting to learn from that toughness and stuff like that? What were some of those interactions and experiences?
Dick was the best. He was. He was the greatest. I mean, I had him for 11 seasons for the Bears. He's the only line coach I had for the Bears. And just his whole technique and philosophy that he taught about your footwork and how to attack a defensive line by run blocking the run game. It's just great. Just his knowledge. He was fun. There's no way we would have the success without Dick. He was definitely good. I always stood right next to him before the national anthem. I remember one time we were playing the Packers. It was like a night game. We were playing Green Bay, and the nose guard I was playing against that night went out there and he sang the national anthem. And I can't remember his name. I don't even know. But he was really good singer. He sang the national anthem, and I'm standing there, and I would just shake hands with Dick. Afterwards, he looks at me, goes, "Make sure that's all he's known for tonight." And I go, "No problem, no problem."
That's funny. The last person in terms of the organization and stuff I want to ask you about is George Halas, where, he was a founder of the NFL. You're playing for one of the iconic organizations in football. what were some of your interactions with George Halas like as a young player?
Yeah, I really, you know, I didn't never had a conversation with him. He would, I think he passed away in 83, I believe, right? Yeah, in 80, he'd come out to practice and he'd have a golf cart and he'd come in and he'd just kind of drive him around and he'd look at practice. And but then I remember my rookie year one time that I thought I was, it was the season had just started and I thought I was going to get cut because I was out, the snappers, the long snappers and punters and punt returners would go out early first for practice. And they had this short field on the very east side of Hal's Hall, right next to the facility in this little octagon room shape. And that's where the coaches would meet. But that's where I'd be there snapping, you know, punts to the punter. And Jeff Fisher was the guy catching the punts. He went on to be the coach and everything. Mm-hmm. And he kept throwing the ball when I was like snapping the next one. He'd throw it and try to hit me in the head. And so he got down close one time. So I started chasing around. And I tried to wing one like right in the back of his leg as hard as I could. And I turn around and I look in the window and there's George Halas looking. And I literally like kind of turned sideways so he wouldn't see my number. I think, oh man, that could be like screwing around out here. But you know, I survived, I guess. But yeah, that was pretty crazy. He gave a talk one time too. I remember we lost a tough game and he told a story about when he was playing baseball. He played with the Yankees and how he slid into second base and Ty Cobb said, "Hey, Rook, you think you're tough like that?" And he goes, "Tell you what," he goes, "show me how tough you are. Meet me out underneath the grandstand after the game." You know, this is George Halas telling the story. Just amazing. And George said that he goes, the rest of the game, I struck out, because I was thinking I'm going to get my butt kicked by Ty Cobb. What do I do? And he said, he goes, "Well, I have to go out there." And so he put his new suit on, walked out there and he walked right up to Ty Cobb's waiting for him. And he walked up to him and Ty Cobb looked at him. He goes, "Way to go, Rook. I didn't think you'd come out here." And just like, to say, continue on. So that's a pretty cool story.
I want to ask a question about the 85 season. I never got to experience it, but I mean, who doesn't love to talk about it? And something I didn't know until I did a little research was your first game of that season was against Tampa Bay. And at the beginning of the game, the first half, you guys were down 17-28. Do you remember what that halftime speech was like from Ditka? I mean, I can only assume what the expectations were like coming into that year and to be in that situation. I'm sure he wasn't too thrilled.
Yeah, there had to be some screaming going on, I'm sure. But we were a pretty confident team. But I do remember being down in that game. But I think Leslie Frazier, the guy went on to be a head coach also, made a nice interception and returned it for a touchdown in that game, kind of turned the tide a little bit. The first couple games of the year we didn't play as smoothly as when we got the momentum going.
What was the expectation for that season, like coming in training camp and everything? It was Super Bowl. It was known.
The obstacle though was the 49ers, because the 84 season we made it the championship game. And I remember going out to San Francisco to play in the championship game, and we were 13-point underdogs. And I'm thinking, no way can we be 13-point underdogs. There's no, I was thinking, man, if I was a betting guy, that's a no-brainer. We got beat 23-0. I mean, they kicked us up and down the field. It was just that we weren't. So when we went back out there in 85, then that's when, that's that when beat them, And, you know, that story I told earlier about Dick, I said, half you guys aren't going to be there. I went out to the stadium early that day and went around the lockers, and there were less than half guys, less than half the team there when Dick had got there.
Another matchup that you guys kind of like, I didn't know about either that I, after I've done research, was with Washington in 84. Yeah. You guys had gone to Washington, beat them for the first time that they had ever lost at home in the playoffs.
And that was a big game for us.
It's a huge game. And then you go, did you guys play them at all in 85 or not?
No.
And then you go 86, 87, play them again, lose both of those games. But like, what is that like? I never knew that there was this, I would assume there was a real hatred between the two because of these very big matchups.
Yeah, they were pretty intense games. They were good games. The Redskins were good. They definitely, we stumbled in the playoffs. You know, you can blame it on injuries, facilities. You know, the one year we went down to South Bend to practice for the week, and I just don't think having us guys, a professional football team in a college town, get prepared for a that just wasn't good. That just wasn't a good fit for us to play winning football. But it'd be different nowadays, I'm sure. But yeah, you know, they had a really good defense. The Redskins, Joe Gibbs played. They played really good football. We just we stumbled in the playoffs for some reason. It was very disappointing.
You talked to earlier about Leslie Frazier, Jeff Fisher. You know, there's also Mike Singletary, who was a head coach, and Ron Rivera. You had so many future NFL head coaches from that 85 team. Why do you think so many guys were able to get head coaching positions and have success in those positions? What do you think, it's because of the coaching staff from that team? Like, what do you think was some of that DNA that they were able to carry with them into their coaching career?
Yeah, you know, I think that's true. I think it really is. I think the guys, our experiences, that group of guys that you mentioned that went on to be head coaches, I mean, that was a real core of success with the Bears. And I think it was just an enjoyable experience. And I think having someone like, as we had Mike Ditka and the level of success that you achieve, it's, you know, we saw a really fun lifestyle. We, you know, we worked really hard, and we probably complained more than anybody else, but deep down, we also had a lot of fun. It was a good time. So it's exciting to see, you know, Leslie, got into coaching because, injury. He actually tore his ACL in the Super Bowl right before halftime on a punt return. And it's too bad, because he was going to be like, he'd probably be a Hall of Fame cornerback. And Jeff Fisher broke his leg on a punt return. So Buddy used to incorporate those guys. And Ron was always a guy that was kind of like, always, you could always tell Ron always, he always like led some like player leadership group or some of the union part, and wanted to always kind of be involved in the signals and play calling. You always could see his interest in football. So it is kind of neat to see the guys, how they've evolved.
Who were some of your favorite guys to match up against? Like, who were either teams or specific guys you love to block, you know, like, Who were some of your favorite matchups?
Oh, well, I don't know. You don't have that. This favorite, I don't know, is the favorite.
Looking forward to competing against, I should say.
You know, seems like I, you know who I played a lot against, like through my whole college and NFL career. And actually my last game was a nose guard from Wisconsin, Tim Krumrie. I played against him, you know, 3 years at Iowa, and then my last game in the NFL. I mean, that's who I was playing against, was Tim Krumrie, you know, after 13 years, which is pretty crazy. But, you know, I suppose there's certain guys that were pretty funny on the field, you know, that you know, it was always kind of fun to compete against, kind of linebackers. But the guys that I actually, you know, would butt heads against, I wouldn't, you know, I didn't want to really get to know them a whole lot. But when I went to Cleveland, though, Jerry Ball was with the Browns, too. And we got to be, we got that training camp. We got to be pretty close and trusting. And I remember one night back at the dorms, there was a ping pong table there. And we started playing like ping pong. And it was just, we got into ping pong, just like it was like the competitive, like we're playing on a football, you know, diving for shots. And, you know, I didn't want to get beat by him and he didn't want to get beat by me too. But, you know, I suppose it's respect. It's fun to play against guys that you respect. That's what it is more than anything. It's fun to compete against guys that you really respect. Like Reggie White, I mean, you know, who wouldn't respect that guy? The fear of that is how are you going to block him? You know, if you set back on a pass block, he's just going to truck you. So you just got to almost block everything like a run and just wish, you know, good luck.
How did matching up against one of the best defenses in practice every day make you better? Like, what did you learn about yourself as a player facing the Hamptons, the Perrys, the Dents? Like,
right.
What was that like for you, you know, going up against the NFL's best every day?
All right. It was great. I was getting coached by the best. I was getting coached by the best and playing against the best every day. So, I mean, you had to be ready to go. You know, it was like the Iowa wrestling room. I mean, if you're not ready to go up and step in that Iowa wrestling room, you're going to get beat, you know, that day. So it was the same thing we had going. Yeah, I mean, how lucky am I? I got to go my rookie year, Alan Page Hall of Fame. I practiced against Dan Hampton Hall of Fame, Mike Singletary Hall of Fame. I mean, it's crazy. It's crazy, coached by a Hall of Famer, you know, so there was a lot of expect, you know, Dick would always come to me, Dick Stanfield, my line coach, after the season, he goes, let me tell you, he talked like this because he got kicked in the throat and he tore his larynx. He goes, hey, I'll tell you, you know, you came in as a free agent. He goes, there's no, you know, either your arrow's pointing up or it's pointing down. There's no, you know, leveling off for you. It's just, so, I mean, that's when I made my first Pro Bowl. It paranoid me so much. I had to keep making the Pro Bowl or they were going to get rid of me.
And you did. I mean, you followed through on that.
All right.
So one of the things I wanted to kind of dive into is you practiced against it every day, like Sam said, this 46 defense and Buddy Ryan. What a phenomenal scheme. And it was, in its time and still is, one of the greatest defenses ever created and put together. But what was there schematically to it that maybe you still see today that allowed it to transcend the NFL at the time? Because was it just the talent that was executing the system, or was it what was being done? Because the amount of takeaways and sacks that were being created were just at a rate that hadn't been seen before.
Yeah, it was crazy. Didn't they put four quarterbacks out in a row, four games in a row, the starting quarterback?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was just crazy what they were doing. I remember one Pro Bowl. It must have been the 85 one because it was sitting out to a Pro Bowl practice. McMahon and I were sitting in the back of the bus, and John Robinson, who's the head coach of the Rams, he came back to the back of the bus and was like, you know, being buddy-buddy with us and talking. And then he starts going, hey, you know that 46 defense – what do you guys do against practice against that defense and stuff? So he was asking questions about it. And yeah, you know, it's both things what you said. We had guys that were Hall of Famers playing out there and guys that should be Hall of Famers at almost every position. And also then they were playing a system that there were so many mental errors on the offense, so many free runners coming through. When they'd line up the linebacker, you know, the two outside linebackers, Otis and Wilbur, to one side, they either the mental errors would just go off the chart. And those guys were relentless too. They loved it. And I'll tell you, Steve McMichael doesn't get the recognition that he deserves. He was one of the greatest inside pass rushers in football. Those guys were fun. We used to have some battles at practice. We used to have some battles.
I'm sure because, I mean, even when I was in high school, it got I mean, you guys were professional athletes. I'm sure it got personal, but it got personal. Like, you know, you have your boys on the offense and your guys on the defense, and you don't want to see one of your guys fall down and then them celebrate about it. Like, you want to get a play back, and it's just this constant back and forth. Like, I'm sure, like,
I got a story, right? Hayden Fry, he would never scrimmage the ones against the ones.
Really?
That was his philosophy, because it gets too intense. And every year we'd always have our scrimmage day. And here we are, it was 1987. And we're running up, we got a play called. And Wilbur Marshall's playing on the left side here. And it's off tackle, off guard. The play side guard pulls and traps Wilbur, who's the outside linebacker. It's Bortsey. And I wanted to knock Wilbur out. So I tell Bortsey, I go, hey, Mark, you just angle down, take my nose guard off my nose. I'm going to snap the ball and pull and trap. I'm trapping for you because I want to knock Wilbur out. And so I did it to Andre Tippett in the Super Bowl. I pulled and trapped Tippett in the Super Bowl just because I wanted to hit him. But I go to Wilbur, I'm running to get him. I'm seeing him when I'm pulling in this trap, and I'm coming full speed, and I see he doesn't see me. I go, oh, this is it. I'm going to get him. And right at the last second he sees me, he just launches into me and just crushes my shoulder. I had to, like, play the whole season with a harness on my shoulder and have it operated on after the season was over, because that scrimmage, it's exactly what Hayden said, you know, never scrimmage the ones against the ones. It gets too intense.
You sound like someone who absolutely enjoyed pulling as a center, and we don't see it a ton anymore.
Oh,
I mean, you see it sometimes, but back then, being 260, 65 pounds, you're able to get out there and move in space.
Yeah, it was fun. We first put it in like in 83 when we were playing against the Cowboys, against the flex defense. They ran this defense where it was an even man line. I was uncovered. But either the strong side or the weak side, I can't remember. One guard was like one tackle was tight on the guard, and the other guy was off the guard, and I can't. And so they kind of hide the linebacker, so he couldn't get the linebacker. And so I was playing in between Noah Jackson and Reeve Sorey then, and I just told them, I go, hey, listen, we'll scoop it. I go, if you want to take the guy that's over you, you do. I'll just read you and I'll just pull. I can pull and catch that old man. He was an old linebacker. He was like a 13-year-old linebacker. I could fly back then. So I could catch. I could go around and catch anybody. So it was fun. We had a great time with it. Great time.
How fun was it to have a guy like Walter Payton and another guy like Jim McMahon behind you? Like, you know, blocking for them, you know, knowing that you guys were going to score when you were driving downfield. Like, what were some fun memories you had playing with them, or off the field memories with them?
Yeah. Walter was great. I was fortunate too. You know, I was lucky. You know, the equipment guy for the Bears when I was there came from the Vikings, and he was good buddies with my uncle. So here I'm a free agent, you know, coming to college, and he lockers me right next to Walter Payton. So I was his locker mate for 6 years. So Walter and I, we were tight. He was just a great, great fun guy. He kept everything just, you know, just, there was an expectation, a level of professional. He was an amazing guy. It's too bad he's not around. It really is, because played every play hard. He didn't talk a whole lot, you know, didn't say a whole lot, but you knew, I mean, during the game, he didn't say a lot, but off the field, he was always really talkative and a lot of fun to be around. And McMahon, he was crazy. He always liked to just kind of poke Dick his buttons, which we kind of liked as the offensive line, because Dick had kind of rode us kind of hard all the time. So we kind of liked how that's the reason I think he kind of poked back at Dick all the time. So, but if wish Jim could have stayed a little healthier, and maybe we would have won one more Super Bowl or a couple more, who knows.
So being Walter's locker mate, did you ever get hooked up with a pair of kangaroos or get a custom headband, or did he give you any of that cool stuff?
Or did he ever talk you into going on those hill runs?
Yeah.
No, I never want to. I would never go on a hill run. There's no way I'd do that. But I got a pair of his shoes, actually. I do. He gave me a pair of his shoes. And there's only one thing I ever asked them to sign. It's a picture. We were playing the Rams. And I got like some nose guard, and I'm like looking back, and there's this huge hole, and I'm just like kind of waiting for him to run by. But he was fun. He was fun. Great. He was great going to Pro Bowls with. It's just one of the. It was cool for me because my uncle, you know, played against my uncle. My uncle tackled Wally Hilgenberg tackled both Gale Sayers and Walter Payton in his career. And then I remember the game that he broke the record, the 275 yards rushing against the Vikings watching. That was the first game my uncle didn't start for the Vikings in a long run for him. So, but no, I was a Viking fan, so I really wasn't a Bear fan, but I just remember Wally always just, you know, has so much respect for Walter Payton before I got there. And then he definitely, Walter Payton lived up to everything that people say about him.
So to follow up on that, I actually read that while I was doing some research. And did you ever say which one was harder to tackle between the two?
I think they were different. I think he hit Gale Sayers. I think he knocked Gale Sayers out one or two times in his career. I kind of eek to say that, but I think it may have been Walter. It may have been Walter. I'm not sure. I think Walter was pretty powerful, and I think Wally was a little older at that time, too.
So for our generation who didn't get to experience Walter Payton and all of his greatness on the field, who would you compare from our generation who we might have grown up and experienced for running back? Obviously, there's no one that really compares to Walter Payton, but someone that we could see or just kind of try and correlate how great he actually was, whether it's how they run, maybe the accolades they had, just anything. So we can try and like understand how great he actually was.
You know what? Walter believed in like hitting people. He was a running back, but he'd hit you. He had these just huge forearms and massive hands. And it was one of his big moves. He was just like forearm. He used to forearm guys. And I remember talking to the team a couple times about, you know, running back coach. Hey, just because you have a football doesn't mean you can't go hit the guy. And that's what he believed in. And so I don't know, you know, it's almost like David Montgomery right now for the Bears, how strong of a runner he is. But David Montgomery, I think he kind of searches out contact more than Walter would. The easy thing about Walter was he was easy to block for because if a play was called to like the six or seven hole or whatever hole it was, he was coming there. So you knew how to do that. And he was a north and south runner. We had designed plays to certain holes. And I remember when he retired, then Neil Anderson was the running back. He was just like, he didn't know where he was going. And that's when I was like telling, and I went up to Dick's office one time. I go, hey, instead of calling a blunt 35, you know, where, you know, or no, a slant 24, you know, the two back to the four hole, that's where this play's designed. The way Walter did it, we could kill it doing that because we knew he was going to be there. Neil doesn't run that way. Why don't we just call it a slant right? And he just goes, hey, that's stupid. Get out of here. So, but that was like that was the first thought of zone blocking.
I was about to ask, that literally sounds like the whole thought of like, how a zone block, you just let them dictate.
Well, and you know what? And that's how you asked the question at the beginning of this interview. That's how football's kind of changed. It's gone instead of the assignment type of blocking where you had so much time. We sat there for hours memorizing, you know, all the different defenses and all of our rules. To now, you know, we got this guy, you make this call. Now it's just, hey, everybody step right a little bit, everybody step left a little bit. It just get big, huge guys. And as Dick Stanfield used to say, it's the ice hooks, you know, the ice man, you get those ice hooks. because and that just makes terrible technique football because you're not playing with your arms inside where you're strong. It's just this. You're gonna get me going. I can go all night on that.
Well, no, that is one of my questions. Is like, how has offensive and defensive line play evolved for better or worse? Because like you do say, it has gone from like man-on-man blocking, knowing your assignment, to just taking that step right and
right.
following your track and letting the back dictate it. Like, is that good or bad in a sense for the game?
Yeah, I mean, it depends if you want to win or lose, you know. If you want to win, you better come off the ball and hit people. Yeah, hey, Jensen, the center for Tampa.
Oh, Ryan Jensen, I love him.
He's my favorite guy. He's my favorite. He's my favorite center in the NFL. I mean, he's great. I mean, I was actually an honorary captain a couple years ago when the Bears played the Buccaneers, and he was out there for the coin toss, and they tell us old guys, I'll just stand off to the side, don't get. And I go, oh, and I walked out, I saw he's out there. I walked right across the middle. I go, I gotta shake a center's hand. You know, so he's great. I mean, that's how you got to play. You got to play a little nasty, you know.
And then another thing I wanted to kind of go back to is Walter. For some reason, he had an unbelievable arm, and they just let him throw the ball in these halfback passes all the time. Was he the first ever RPO? Because he could take the ball out on a toss or just say, hey, I'm going to throw it. Like, it really seemed like there was a run pass option with Walter.
Oh, yeah. No, we played a game with him playing quarterback. He came.
We were on like a wildcat almost the whole game.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. We'd gotten all of our quarterbacks hurt, and we had Rusty. What's his name? Can't remember. Rusty Lish. We were playing at San Diego on a Monday night game, and everybody else got hurt. Rusty Lish was our only quarterback, and he made some dumb play, and Dicka yelled at him. And Dicka, and he told Dicka, he goes, hey, listen, he goes, I quit. He goes, I'm gonna quit until you apologize to me. He went and sat on the bench, and Dicka had to go and apologize to him and to get him back out there. And so the next week, I think he cut him when we got back home, but that next week, I think they brought some other quarterback in, but we went with Walter just coming out as a quarterback. I was just shotgun snapping to him, and he's doing the wildcat. He's dropped back playing court. He's just throwing everything so high over when he's dead, though. His arm was so strong, you know. He was just we tried to apply for about a few plays in a quarter or something. But
I wanted to ask you, so we're recording this on a Monday, the day after Super Bowl Sunday. So what is your post-game reaction to the Bucs Chiefs Super Bowl? And, you know, from a lineman standpoint, what did you think about how the Bucs played the game? You know, the Chiefs O-line fell apart. So, like, yeah. You know, can you kind of give us your take on it?
Yeah, you know, Tampa just kept improving during the year. I think that's really – that's what you have to really do is try to get better as the season went. And man, Tom Brady, just amazing, amazing. That defensive line, they contained Mahomes. I think they rushed him great. They made him roll out, but then he couldn't get upfield and get to an open spot. They made him turn back around field a bunch of times, and he's going to lose every time they do that. So it's I was kind of pulling for the Chiefs. I'm good friends with Dave Tobe, the special teams coach of the Chiefs. So I was kind of pulling for him, but they had a good year, but they're not looking at it that way right now. But it's amazing what Tom Brady can do. That guy is truly an incredible person.
Well, I want to ask you, like, you know, watching Tom Brady, you went up against Montana and the 49ers and that whole era. So, like, to you – you know, put the rings aside, who's the better quarterback between Montana, just talent wise, pure talent?
Oh, it's Tom Brady. It's just that guy's unbelievable. I mean, hey, I played one season with Belichick. For him to play 19 years with Belichick, that's amazing. I mean, because there's a lot of stuff that you don't get to do kind of that you want to do, you'd like to do or think about. It's pretty much everything's a cookie cutter for everybody. And
just describing the Patriot way is what Bill calls it?
Yes. Yeah. But yeah, what are they saying? No, it was the Brady way.
And you see what happens. There was a video of inside the Buck locker room of all the Buccaneer players celebrating, going absolutely bananas. And there's Tom in his stall, just business as usual. He's been there. And there was a take I heard, and I do not watch ESPN for like their takes on TV, but it was just on in the background. And I heard someone say that it wasn't necessarily like Tom Brady coming in and then just everything magically became awesome. It was everyone on that team knew that they could buy in the time was. It took, maybe it wasn't right away, but he came in and he wasn't able to in offense to hurt. They did do everything online. And like you said, they progressively got better throughout the year and played their best game in the last game. You know, you don't see that. And for the entire team to buy into Tom Brady, this 43-year-old anomaly, like you'll never see that again. Someone said, right. Someone compared it to if Wizards Michael Jordan had won another NBA Finals.
I don't like that.
I didn't know, but it was interesting to think about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I think what they've done, it is buying in, and it's Tom Brady. How can you not buy? Hey, I tell you, they're smart too. I mean, Tristan Wirfs.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what a great draft pick for Tampa. I'm just unbelievable. I mean, he should be rookie of the year.
I said that he was the one of only two rookies to get all pro votes.
Right. You know, hey, if he's not their right tackle, if he's not their tackle this season, they're not winning the Super Bowl. I mean, look what the Chiefs, they couldn't, how important those guys are. I mean, it's Brady needs the pass blockers there. I mean, it's pretty cool. And you know what's also neat is, I don't know if you saw it at the end of the game, talking about an older Iowa Hawkeye, Tom Moore, was on the sideline and gave Bruce Arians a hug. And he was like a coach and player at Iowa in the 50s. And he's like the oldest assistant coach in the NFL. My father actually was his freshman coach.
Oh, really?
At Iowa.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Hasn't he been in the NFL for like 42 years?
Yes. Uh-huh. Yeah. He's a great guy.
I want to ask you another current question, which is the current state of the Chicago Bears. I want to ask you quarterback wise, what you think should happen there. Do you think that the Bears team identity has to change where it should be ever like less defensive focused and more offensive focused with all of our troubles on the offensive side of the ball?
Yeah. Yeah. I think they got to build a team that can beat Aaron Rodgers right now. I mean, that's what they have to do. So they got to get the guys that, you know, they got the new defense coordinator coming in this year, you know, Todd Bowles, maybe the Tampa, the talent, but that's really what they need. You know, the big story now is that they're talking about bringing Carson Winston. And I'm not so sure about that. If I think that's the way to go, I mean, is it going to cost the Bears draft choice to bring him in? And then you're going to be paying him big time salary cap money. You're risking a lot right there. And I do a little pre and post game radio for the Bears on WBBM. And I'd been saying almost when Mitch came back and started playing that, and look at the free agents out there. I mean, who are you going to find that's really going to be better than Mitch that's out there right now? If you can utilize him and just have a good running attack, a good offensive line, the tight end position, the receiver. I mean, if you can have the whole offense around that position that ready to go, unless you make a big trade for someone that you believe in, it's going to be interesting. It's kind of it's a frustrating to be a Bear fan here in Chicago right now. It really is.
Definitely.
Too bad. It's too bad. I feel bad for the fans because they're the very loyal fans. And but you know, being an ex-offensive lineman, I just think the fundamentals of the run game in the NFL are so poor the way the O-lines are blocking now is so poor, and just the tackling's bad in the NFL too, is if you could just work on those two things right there, you could be pretty dominant, have a winning team in the NFL. But to make it over the place, to make to win that Super Bowl, Brady's proved, you got to have the quarterback.
I have just a few final questions for you.
Sure.
So one question I want to ask you is about the Super Bowl shuffle. You weren't featured in it. So like what happened there? Like, were you asked to be in it and you decided not to, or like, you know, what was that whole thing like when the guys came in, they're like, we're creating a song.
Right. Well, I didn't know anything about it until the one game we lost that year was against the Miami Dolphins on a Monday night, and we're flying back to Chicago, and Willie Gault comes up to me and goes, hey, you know, there's a bunch of us guys going down to the Park West doing this video thing about the Super Bowl. And I look at, and he goes, we'd like to have you be in it. Of course, I wasn't going to be like one of the, say, I was going to be a background guy. And I go, Willie, I go, we just got our ass kicked on national TV. I go, I'm not going to go there and sing about any Super Bowl. So I just kind of blew it off. So. But they got up, I guess they got up really early in the morning that morning and went down there and did the whole thing all day long. So it was pretty crazy.
And two other Super Bowl related questions I have for you are, what is your favorite memory from that weekend? Whether it's, you know, the confetti coming down and you guys win it, a specific play from that game or celebration after, like, what was your favorite part of that experience?
Well, it was kind of family. It's family related, because my uncle Wally started four Super Bowls for the Vikings, and you know, they didn't win any of them. And to have my mom and dad and, you know, brothers and sisters and everybody down in New Orleans for the game. And in the second quarter, when we scored a touchdown late in the second quarter, I knew we had the game won. And I looked up in the stands where they were at and waved to them, and knew we had it clinched then. So it was that was pretty cool. It was pretty cool going into the locker room at halftime knowing we had the Super Bowl won. That was fun.
That's pretty cool. So then my final question for you, and I have to ask this, is once you win the Super Bowl, you know, get to raise the Lombardi, you get a ring. What did you do with the ring? Like, are you a guy that wears the ring out? Do you just keep it somewhere safe? Like, do you have it displayed? Like, what did you do with the ring?
You know, when I got the ring, I said, I'm not going to wear this ring until we get the next one. And so I went years, you know, until like my career was all over, until I put it on. And I don't wear it much at all. But the bear ring is so, people, I don't even think they realize it's like a Super Bowl ring. It's not like the huge thing now, but yeah, that was, it's nice to have the ring. It's a nice thing. It's what they always said, that if something they can't take away from you, something you can't ever take away from you. So it was a fun time. A lot of great guys. A lot of good memories. Friendships still today. We're still there's a big always once a month at least. There's a huge group chat. Text thing going around with a bunch of the guys, mostly the defensive guys.
So I guess I have to end on this question then. Who are some of the guys that are most active on the group chat, and who are some of the guys you get together with the most out, you know, from that team?
Hampton's always the big ring leader on the group chats and everything like that. So he gets it going, and him and Richard Dent likes to throw it out there too. So, but you know, I was fortunate enough to I had a passion for golf, and I developed a golf course just over the border in Kenosha, Wisconsin. And so we get up there together and play a lot of golf together, a lot of us guys. Like Mike Tomczak comes in quite a bit and plays. And Tom Thayer, he's a good friend of mine. So So
that's awesome.
We have a bunch of guys. Jim Morrissey, he's the guy that stopped Chuck Long from going to the Hawkeyes, going to the Rose Bowl on the 1 yard line. I don't like the guy. Tell him that. Oh, okay. Here's a funny story about Jim Morrissey. He wore number 50. He was like I think he may have been like a 7th, 8th round draft choice, but his rookie year, he wore number 51 for the Bears. Jim Morrissey. That's Dick Butkus's number.
Yeah.
So here's Jim Morrissey wearing 51. His rookie year, he tells this story. He goes, he was so nervous the first game of the year. He got to the stadium before – he got to the locker room before anybody else got there and got completely dressed in his uniform because he was so nervous. And he's sitting there in his uniform, and Dick Butkus was actually doing the radio back then. And here comes Dick Butkus walking in the locker room, and it's just him and Morrissey in the locker room. And Dick looks at him, and Jim's, you know, across the locker room. Here he's wearing 51 looking at Dick Butkus, and he feels like he has to walk over. He walks over and he goes, Mr. Butkus, he goes, just to let you know, this wasn't my idea to get this number. He goes, that's okay, kid. Just make me proud. Keep the grass stains off the back of it.
That's legendary. That's a legendary story. That's awesome.
That was funny. He loves telling that story.
That's awesome. Jack, do you have any final questions?
I don't. This has been absolutely awesome. We can't thank you enough for coming on and doing this. Seriously, this has been awesome. So as always, guys, not the same time, same place. We will see you guys later.